The masters almost surely have a plan. There's clearly maybe something there beyond the realm of man. And until you've thoroughly tested every last close trusted view, I find the more you think you know, the less you really do.
That's true, Dr. Zaius.
Very well.
Where would we be without THC? 'Cause we know they're lying to us, just don't know.
Here we go, our side chatters. I hope you're sitting down, drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke, and altering to keep from faltering with the ever-persistent buzzing of conventional reality right in my ear. From sunny San Diego, I'm Greg Carlwood, and we're all vaguely familiar with the Knights Templar, but I think their true rights and motivations are still a bit of a mystery, and their quick rise to being one of the largest economic powers of their day sure makes one curious. We do know opinions on them range from being the elite, noble soldiers of Christ to demon-worshipping occultists knee-deep in bestiality and pedophilia, and many of the rumors have suggested that the Knights Templar upheld a secret doctrine behind the veil of their holy public image. Well, we've heard of the proverbial deal with the devil, and we're no stranger to the idea of initiatory orders using magic to acquire wealth and power, but where does this all come from? What are the beliefs and worshipped entities that are linked to this behavior? Are we looking at just another dense mythology or a true source of dark power? How far can we trace it? Kabbalistic mystery schools, hermetic wisdom, Gnostic teachings, it can get confusing, but here to give us a roadmap to realization once again is Tracy Twyman. Tracy's been writing about the esoteric side of history and current events for over 20 years, dealing with topics like secret societies, ancient myths, demonology, ceremonial magic, divination, alchemy, mind control, mystic royal bloodlines, and the hidden history of money, just to name a few. Last time she was on THC, we talked mainly about her book Clock Shavings, which details her personal journey into direct contact with the entity known as Baphomet. And he's definitely coming up again today as we talk about her newest book, Baphomet, the Temple Mystery Unveiled. Tracy Twyman, welcome back to THC.
Thank you so much, Greg. I'm really glad to be on this program again. It was the most responded to podcast that I did last year when I did all those interviews for Clock Shavings. So I'm really happy to be on again.
Oh, wow. Right on. I love to hear that the people are responding. You know, I really love that show. And I actually really enjoyed this latest book of yours. It's almost 600 pages unpacking all the myths and rumors and various scholars' opinions on a whole host of topics surrounding Baphomet, the Knights Templar, and the tracing of these dark magical practices, all while trying to get to the truth of the matter. But it's definitely helped clarify some of this stuff for me. And I guess to get the ball rolling here, let's lay a good base. Introduce the people to the Knights Templar as you understand them. What do you think they need to know?
Well, the only thing you really need to know, you know, that they were a crusading order that was founded by or chartered by the Catholic Church, founded by several noblemen from Europe and a friend of theirs, Saint Bernard of Clairvaux. And their purpose, allegedly in the beginning, was to protect pilgrims on the route to the Holy Land. And they were given this property to use as their headquarters that was actually on the Temple Mount there in Jerusalem. So that's how they got their name, which was words translating to the poor knights of the Temple of Solomon. And what ended up happening with this group, they were widely respected at the time. They existed from about, I would say, the late 11th century to the early 14th century. And most of that time, they were very widely respected as a military fighting force, for one. Mm-hmm. And they also branched out into other areas of business, basically, especially after the crusading career sort of died down. And they began to return to Europe and take properties there and were running businesses out of their properties. These properties, these areas, they were given these areas called preceptories. They were allowed to basically run their own sovereign space there, basically. They were considered to be only beholden to the Pope. So other princes and kings, emperors who, you know, had temporal power in the places where they were at, they didn't actually have any power over the Templars themselves. They were sort of their own sovereign entity.
Gotcha.
And so they were able to use that leverage, basically, that advantage that they had, I think, in business. So it's widely reported that they basically started the first checking system.
Right.
And the first international banking system. And this really connects to this idea of them protecting the pilgrims on the route to the Holy Land, because one of the problems with pilgrimages was that, you know, people would be susceptible to theft and vandals and people attacking them along the route. So what would, you know, made that a little bit safer is if people didn't have to carry so much gold and silver bullion with them.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, they were able to make a deposit at these banks that were run at Templar preceptories, and they would be given this chit. That's what it was called. It was a check, essentially. It was written with coded numbers or symbols on it that represented that person's account, you know, how much was in it and who they were. So they could go to the next preceptory along the route to the Holy Land as they progress along their journey. And they might stop there and stay the night, you know, so it was basically acting as a hotel. But they could present their chit there, and they would be able to pay for all of the accommodations that they needed there. And that amount would just be deducted from their account. And it would all be squared away at the end when they're done with their journey. They can go back to the preceptory where they started the account and cash out any money they had left in there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that essentially is the first international banking and checking system. And, you know, as far as we know, it's something they invented. And this is really what contributed to their great rise of power of this organization. And what ended up happening by the time they fell, basically, by the time they were disbanded, which was the early 14th century, they had become so powerful that the kings in Europe were actually afraid of them. A lot of them owed them money, including King of France. And they were sort of considered lawless. You couldn't do anything to rein them in. And rightfully, I think these powerful potentates in Europe were afraid of them.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, the King of France also had a great deal of influence over the papacy. And in fact, at this exact time that I'm describing, the king, who was Philip IV, had actually persuaded them to move their headquarters from Rome to Avignon, France, and it remained there for some time. So the kings of France had been pushing the popes around for quite a few years. And, you know, since he was concerned about the Templars, and one of the bones of contention also was that Philip had actually tried to join the order and been rebuffed.
Oh, no.
And so he was upset about all these things. They were rumored to just have vast amounts of wealth. And in fact, a lot of rumors were flying around this time. You know, people were wondering how they became so wealthy. And we can understand now that banking is probably the most lucrative enterprise anyone could be involved in, because you can actually create money out of nothing and greatly increase the amount of wealth that you had when you started.
Right.
So that's understood by us now. But back then, I think it was a new concept and people didn't really understand it. And people thought something mysterious was going on here. They're wondering, you know, how these people got to be so powerful so quickly. And so some of the rumors that were flying around back then were that they had made a pact with the devil and they were doing satanic rituals, essentially, in their secret initiation rites.
Mm-hmm.
And Philip heard some of these rumors and he sent spies to confirm the rumors. And apparently they did confirm those rumors. So then he used this as evidence, basically, to get the Pope involved in colluding with them to prosecute these people.
Mm-hmm.
And actually had them arrested. A lot of them ended up getting burnt at the stake. Some of them, I would say the vast majority of them didn't. You know, they just received some form of penance and then they were absorbed into other orders.
Like the Nazis.
Yeah. Anyway, this whole episode in history has been really mythologized ever since. And it's really kind of confusing what to even make of it. I mean, you've got, on the one hand, up until recently, the church hasn't looked back with regret on this incident. There are several popes actually have spoken about the Templars and confirmed this idea that they were heretics and blasphemers and involved in devil worship, and also that they were conspiring to take over the world.
Mm-hmm.
The classic global conspiracy theory, Well, I guess this is the origin of that. I think what we consider the classic secret society conspiracy theory that the Satanists are conspiring to take over the world. It started there with the Templars being accused of that by the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
But then you also have in the intervening years since 1307, when the Templars were disbanded, lots of rumors have been built up about how they were wrongly persecuted and they were really innocent. And actually they were these sort of wise initiates of, you know, the secrets of Western occultism. And then all of the major Western occult groups that have existed since then have somehow or another tried to tie themselves to the Knights Templar and claim that they are continuing their mystical tradition.
Right.
But very little is actually known about the mystical tradition of the Templars. You got to wonder where these groups are getting their information, where they claim that they're somehow continuing what the Templars did. they're certainly assuming that whatever the Templars were doing was somehow positive and, you know, that it reflects well on them. And I'm speaking, of course, of the Freemasons, which are explicitly tied with the Templars. And many of the Masonic rites actually involve pretending you're a Knights Templar, going back to that era and exploring the foundations of Solomon's Temple and things like that. And there's even a degree in New York Rite of Freemasonry that's called that, the Knights Templar degree. So there's definitely a connection between these two things. Masonic literature written by Masonic scholars such as Morals and Dogma by Albert Pike goes into a great deal of speculation and theory about what the Templars were involved in. Does definitely seem to be tying in the rites of Freemasonry with the Templar tradition, whatever that was. And then several other groups like the OTO and the Rosicrucians also, claim a connection.
Right. And that is a great summary of their story. And I guess when they were being tortured, it was Baphomet who they apparently gave credit to for their wealth and power. But the thing is that a lot of people, like you say, there is a weird perception of the Templars where it seems like in recent years, people are looking at it with rose-colored glasses like they were noble guys. I mean, maybe Dan Brown's books have something to do with that. But I guess when I've had guests talk about the Templars and this idea that they were involved in dark rituals, they always say, oh, you know, the rumors of human sacrifice and bestiality, those are just rumors and things they confess to under torture, which, you know, that's a fair argument. But are there any other indications that we can get that this wasn't just an admittance under duress of torture? I mean, I guess the spies corroborating the story would be one thing. Is there anything else that leads us to believe this is truth rather than just something they said to stop the burning?
Well, first of all, I neglected to actually describe the Baphomet connection. Yes, Baphomet is the name of a severed head that the confessing Templars described under torture. Yes, where they said that they were worshiping. This was the name of their idol that they were worshiping, Baphomet. They described it as a severed head or a skull. They said it sometimes had two faces, that it was really terrible to behold. And the descriptions give the indication that there was probably one actual original Baphomet head that might have been at their grand headquarters. And then all the other preceptories would have their own version of it. So there were probably several different Baphomet heads, but one, you know, major head that all the other ones were basically copies of.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, this is a very consistent confession from several of them. So I think it's interesting. One of the things about the confessions is just how detailed they are. And then the details matching up, you know, from person to person. So, you figure they're not making this stuff up, or it seems that way to me.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But the other thing is that not all of the confessions were made under torture. And this is something that I actually sort of pulled together here in the last few months as, you know, we were doing the final edits on the book. I was sort of forced by my co-author, Alex Rivera, to look at this subject that I had kind of glossed over for the last several years. I've known about it, but not really read about it in detail. And it's this thing called the Chinon Parchment.
Mm-hmm.
And what this is, it was allegedly discovered in 2001 by an archivist basically working for the Vatican in their secret archives. She says that her name's Barbara Frail. She just sort of came across this thing that had been misfiled for 700 years.
Convenient.
And yeah, so anyway, and then they sat on it for many years. I think they finally came out with, I think it was 2007 when they finally put out a book about it. It took a long time for them to, you know, announce this, and they did so in the form of a book, which they wanted to promote. They actually announced the book on the anniversary of this Templar arrest.
Wow.
And it was very peculiar because it was a limited edition book. I think it was in Italian, and it was like leather bound, and it had all of these artistically done little like bookmarks and stuff. It was meant to look old, you know, like mm-hmm. this old precious document. And retail price cost $9,000. There was only a few of them made.
Damn.
Right. So it's a little bit odd because, okay, like I said, first they sat on this information for years, and then they put it out in this limited edition book that obviously almost nobody has and can read.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was the press reported about the discovery of this document, apparently without actually reading very much about it at all. That's what I found when I started going through all the articles, is that it seemed like they were just sort of regurgitating a press release. But since no, I guess most of at least the English language press that I was reading, I guess most of the people who wrote those articles probably didn't read Italian. So maybe they hadn't read what Barbara Frail actually wrote.
Right.
So here's how it got reported, was that the Vatican had just discovered this exculpatory document that shows that the Pope actually had his own investigation and his own cardinals interrogated the same Templars who had confessed to the Inquisition in France. And his discovery was that he also had them confess several of the same things, apparently not under torture, according to the document. So the way it was reported is that the Pope's investigation revealed that they were innocent, and then they were absolved and essentially apologized to, and that somehow after that, everything went wrong anyway, and they ended up getting burnt at the stake anyway by the French. It was the Vatican kind of washing its hands of this and acting like, well, you know, we didn't do anything wrong. We tried to help. And we didn't do anything wrong totally, because they're also absolving themselves of the guilt of having chartered a Satan worshiping organization to represent them in the Holy Land.
Mm-hmm.
Because what had been believed up until then was that the church had created this group, allowed them to have total power, and then let them go unchecked as they devolved into a Satan worshiping cult that tried to take over the world. So here they are, you know, saying, well, none of that was true in the first place. The thing is that it's not actually what it says, but that is the way that it's being spun. And it just took me forever to try to figure this out. I wrote to my friends, I wrote to Alex, the co-author, and some of the other people that have been helping me do the research on this book, just telling them, look at this information. Does it really look like what is in the Chinon parchment matches with what is being said in these articles? And they all agreed with me. No, it doesn't match.
Hmm.
So it's very, I just kept questioning myself. How could I be right about this? And all these other people be wrong. But what it is basically this. When Barbara Frail says that the Pope absolved them, well, he was just doing what priests do. You know, they take a confession and then they come up with some kind of punishment, usually involving, you know, prayers and penance and things like that.
Yeah.
Then they give you absolution. Then they give you forgiveness from Jesus, you know? So that's what was happening. It was in no way saying that these knights weren't guilty of what they had just confessed to.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did confess to the Pope's cardinals in this special investigation without torture was that, yes, they were spitting on the cross, which is one of the things they, you know, were accused of and confessed previously to,
mm-hmm.
that during their initiation ceremony, you would have to spit on the cross and deny Christ.
Okay.
And so that in itself is a little bit weird. Okay, this is a Christian crusading organization. What the heck about that? And then the other thing that they confessed to was that they had a policy of homosexuality. And here's what that amounted to, according to their confessions, that initially you would take a vow of chastity. But even as you're taking this vow, you're being told that, well, if you're not capable of keeping this vow and you end up seeing some prostitutes, just make sure you don't tell the other knights about that, because that will discourage them from their own vow of chastity.
Hmm.
This was how it started out. According to the confessions of these knights, they said, in the beginning, the vow of chastity was made, but they were also given this caveat about how to deal with it if they couldn't actually control themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Then later that evolved into an even different policy, which the person who's authored the policy confessed to right there to the cardinals. And I think that was Geoffrey de Charny. Anyway, he said that the policy evolved into this. You would be told that you absolutely must abstain from fraternizing with women. But if you find yourself unable to control your urges, you should seek relief with the other knights instead. And also, you would literally take a vow that if the other knights came to you needing their own needs met, that you should not refuse them. So you're literally taking, not only you start off renouncing Christ, but then you take a vow that you're going to have sex with the other guys if they want it. And so strangely, this is somehow wrapped up in piety and chastity, as though you're pure because you're not touching women. But, you know, you're literally being told something you might not even have thought of before. It might not even have occurred to you
that
you're supposed to have sex with these other guys. So, I mean, these are the things they confess to. And I'm just trying to think if I'm forgetting anything else that was actually mentioned in the Chinon parchment. Those are the major things, you know, homosexuality and what seems to be blasphemy confessed right out there. That it was not just something that happened occasionally. It was a policy.
Well, that is interesting that we now have another source for their confessions rather than just torture. But one thing, you know, I'm always curious about is the actual power of ceremonial magic, or if it's just a superstition. You know, did they have these beliefs and happen to amass a bunch of wealth, or was the magic really responsible? You know, we see athletes drop to their knees after a big play and thank God. Well, you know, how much of that is God and how much of that is the fact that you trained every day of your life? And I guess the question is, do we get any indications, or from the research you've done, have you seen anything that would suggest that the magic was real?
Well, just sort of logic, really. If you think about it, one of the things they said, they believed in this head, that it was their savior, that it gave them wisdom, it caused the trees to germinate and the land to be fruitful, and it caused them to become wealthy. Well, these things are not necessarily unconnected. I mentioned that I think, you know, a great source of their wealth was their banking empire.
Right.
Well, that, you know, coming up with that was sort of a stroke of genius. No one in particular is credited with having invented it. So I do kind of wonder if that idea was given to them in their ceremonies.
Yeah. Well,
the worship of this head, they describe it as a prophetic head, that they said that it talked to them. Okay, this is something that has antecedents in the history of ritual magic, and particularly Middle Eastern cults in the area where they were stationed at the time. Particularly, there's this practice of using something called a teraph, or teraphim is the plural version of that. This is an embalmed severed head. Often it's described that you would use a severed baby's head.
Yikes.
So, you know, some infant that's just been born would be sacrificed for this. And then you'd embalm the head and put it onto a plate or, you know, some sort of charger and write magical words and symbols on the tongue of the infant that would cause it to come to life. And then it would speak to you. It would, you know, answer whatever questions you had.
Hmm.
Be a prophet for you, basically. So I'm figuring that this is what they were doing with Baphomet. You know, they already admitted they were talking to it. They were probably using it for divination.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't doubt if it gave them wisdom. Now, of course, I mean, you and I are talking from the perspective of people that have, you know a lot about occultism. And I don't know about you, but I mean, I've experienced a little bit of, you know, the power of these practices too. And as we discussed last time I was on. So,
yeah.
I mean, to, you know, you might not consider it a scientific statement here, but as I personally think it's quite possible that they talked to a spirit that gave them information about how to create a banking empire, how to leverage for their own advantage the fact that they had been given a charter that left them beholden to nobody but the Pope. Because it's very basically that's the source of political entities today that are powerful. Is, you know, like the United States, up until recently, you know, has dominated the world financially. And that really comes from the fact that they are issuing the, what until recently was considered the reserve currency of the world. So all of the other central banks that are part of this international system are holding dollars in their own banks as the basis of their own monetary system in their own countries. And then they'll issue a domestic currency that's still only considered to be valuable in terms of dollars, really. And this is because they sort of have declared to themselves the right to do that, you know, and that right has not been checked until recently. The reason why the United States' global dominance financially is being challenged now is not unrelated to the fact that their military dominance is in a way being challenged too. And in that, they're vulnerable.
Right.
You know, the United States is vulnerable now militarily in a way that they weren't. We're vulnerable to terrorist attacks. We're vulnerable to Russia. Whereas in the past, nobody could do anything to the United States. You know, they sort of created their own international sovereignty and declared their own right to make reality for everybody else.
Right.
That is why they were able to have so much power. So what I'm saying, I guess, is that the Templars were doing something similar. You know, they claimed that, you know, no one else had any power over them. And realistically, nobody did until the very end when someone finally checked their power.
Yeah, I totally think that this is all possible. And I know you do have a book about Solomon's treasure. And I've heard researchers try to make the case before that the early Masonic founders of America had found this lost treasure after the Templars and used it to build up this new Atlantis idea in America.
Yes.
But following what you're saying, it seems like you consider this treasure to be more of the actual secret alchemical formula for wealth creation rather than a physical pile of gold. Maybe it was divined from this entity, but that's kind of your interpretation of something like Solomon's treasure, if I understand, right?
That is basically the sort of thing I was hinting at in Solomon's treasure. I kind of trace the history of the esoteric history of money, the alchemical connections with the way monetary systems have been run, and also the symbols that are used on currency or alchemical. And yeah, as I was tracing the history of money, you know, sort of highlighted the influence of the Templars and the influence of concepts that are basically connected to the same concept as Baphomet. And so I was hinting without actually coming out and saying it necessarily that it seems that throughout history, you can see the what it seems like a sort of center of power, you know, in the world shift around, and it, and along with it goes monetary power.
Yeah.
And, you know, this a place such as Byzantium, for instance, will become the center of global commerce for a while. And then as history moves along, it'll shift to some other place. And what it seemed to me like is that these shifts were happening from the Knights Templar onward in ways that indicated to me that these new places might be the new location of the Baphomet treasure, or the relic, the head itself might actually have been moved from place to place. And as it moved, it brought with it the power to create this wealth. And I think that it manifested itself in the form of the creation of monetary systems. So it ended up eventually, it seems, in the hands of the United States, and that was used as the basis for creating a international monetary empire.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know that the Baphomet head itself is here in the United States, but it seems like the power of it was transferred here for a while.
Right.
And that it at one time had been in Byzantium, and it just so happens there in formerly Constantinople and now Istanbul, there's a head of John the Baptist there. Well, a lot of people have theorized that the Baphomet head that the Templars were worshiping was actually the head of John the Baptist.
Right.
And the Templars actually were involved in relic trading quite a lot. In fact, we sort of traced the, there's several different versions of John the Baptist's head floating around, and there have been throughout the years, but we found that at least two of them could be connected to crusaders trading them and helping to move them around. So I think it's quite possible that the Templars did have access to something that they thought was John's head. And I wouldn't doubt if that's the one that ended up in the museum in Istanbul now.
Damn. Yeah, I definitely do have a couple of questions for you about the head of John the Baptist. But I wanted to ask you one more thing about money and magic, because I definitely see the links between money and magic. And there's definitely a lot of occult undertones to early America. And, you know, we're talking about that knowledge coming to them and helping them build the empire here. And it seems like whoever has this entity-inspired knowledge has the power. But how does this jive with the Jewish banking families? And it is interesting that they also have a tradition of magic in the Kabbalah. But is this another branch of the same knowledge, or is it a totally different thing altogether?
Yeah, I would say it's a branch of the same knowledge. Yeah, I tend to be very syncretist in my approach of studying things, you know, and I don't care what people say. I think that it's much more useful to note the similarities between mythologies and spiritual traditions rather than pointing out the differences. You just get more use out of that. So,
fair.
Definitely, I think that there's in almost every culture a traditional way of trying to approach finances, and there's always been considered to be sort of a mystery around it. And you can find actually sort of a corpus of a body of symbols that all seem to connect together almost in every culture, you know, all being part of the same archetype. And I think that this is essentially what we think of as the Baphomet archetype. Now, this is what our book is all about, really, is trying to trace the origins of this archetype. You know, we're not just dealing with the history of the Knights Templar. That's only one aspect of it, really.
Right.
That would be the Templars probably used the word Baphomet originally. They were the first ones to use that particular word, but the concept is older than that. So I think it has to do with, for one thing, this idea of hidden wisdom. So, you know, in Judeo-Christian tradition, we think of that as, we associate that with the serpent, with the evil one, that hidden or forbidden, but nonetheless divine wisdom was given to us against the wishes of the Almighty God by, you know, this nefarious serpent character. And this is the sort of wisdom, not only is it divine and it gives you sort of spiritual insights, but it also has practical applications, and that people who are able to access this knowledge can create empires of wealth somehow. There's an association in our culture of riches somehow being connected to making a satanic pact.
Yes.
Which is essentially what the Adam and Eve situation was. They had been told by God, you know, don't eat this fruit or you'll die. Of course, the serpent said you won't die, but he was just basically talking. He was defining death differently. So, it sounds like, eating the fruit did result in sort of the initiation of death and birth that didn't exist before, apparently.
All right.
Anyway, so I'm saying, like, there were deadly consequences to the pact that they made, but they did it so that they could gain that knowledge. And then from that point on in the biblical narrative, you have repeatedly associations with, what are considered villainous characters and wisdom. So in particular, practical wisdom. So Cain and all of his descendants are credited in the Bible with having invented almost all of the, you know, major arts of civilization, including agriculture and metallurgy and music making and things like that, tent making even. So it's interesting that we have this association in our culture between, you know, wisdom and having the ability to do practical things somehow with the devil. And this image of the serpent on the tree is really what evolved into two things. For one, the symbol of magic now in Western occultism. It's also a symbol of the healing arts, being a doctor. And I'm talking about the caduceus. So yeah, you'd have two serpents on a caduceus. There's another version, the rod of Asclepius, that only has one serpent. But basically, I think this is connected to the idea of the serpent on the tree.
Right. And the dollar sign, too.
And then, yeah, as I theorize, I think that the dollar sign is a glyph representing this. And I actually trace this back to one of the first coins to be minted that seems to have been the origin of this. It's called a thaler. And before the word became associated with English, because people were using dollars in the English colonies in the Americas, the word thaler actually was a German word. And so there were coins circulating in, you know, Germany and Bohemia that were called thalers. And one of them in particular actually had on one side it had this image from the Bible where there's this story about Moses and, you know, he's talking to his people there. They get bit by fiery serpents.
Weird.
It was something described as fiery serpents. And then God inspires Moses on how to heal them from their serpent bites that they were apparently dying from. And he was instructed him to make a serpent out of brass, a serpent on a rod out of brass, and raise it up. And everyone that looked at it was healed.
Hmm.
And then this actually gets referred to later in the New Testament. There's a sort of comparison, a symbolic comparison between Jesus on the cross and this brazen serpent. Nehushtan, that's the word I was trying to think of. The word for the brazen serpent on a staff being raised up and used in this manner to heal people, the word is called Nehushtan.
Mm.
So later in the Gospels, the crucified Jesus is compared to the Nehushtan. And basically, it seems to me that this symbol of the Nehushtan on a thaler influenced the dollar symbol later. So, and interesting coincidence too is the person who ran that mine that minted those coins was also an alchemist.
Hmm.
So anyway, you know, that's interesting. The history of money is totally tied in with the history of alchemy in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, and that connection between Jesus on a cross and the snake on a cross is really interesting because another big idea that gets explored here a lot is just the idea of the deity flip, kind of the Gnostic idea that the creator of the material world is a negative entity, not necessarily the all-loving God that the three major religions will have us believe today, that people put all their energy in worshiping today, that would be a negative entity. And then you see also a flipping of, you know, because snakes, of course, are thought to be pretty negative in the biblical context. And then we're seeing a flip here with Jesus. There's also an interesting little thing from your book that I copied down because I just thought it was pretty provocative. But apparently you say there were Talmudic rumors that John had a demonic servant and that the control of this demon was passed on to Jesus. It seems possible for there to have been a belief that Jesus, who was related to King Herod's bloodline, may have somehow gotten hold of John's head and used it to control either John's own spirit or a spirit that John had formerly controlled while he was alive. This head, then, may have later come into the hands of the founding Templars. That's pretty provocative. I mean, that's not a perspective you hear every day.
Well, it's actually alluded to in the Gospels that, you know, Jesus was accused of having a demon. And then that Jesus was accused of being the reincarnated John, and which is odd because they barely talk to each other. There's only the one meeting in the Gospels between Jesus and John, you know, during the baptism of Jesus. And then later, John's followers come and visit Jesus and ask him, you know, if seem to be asking him if he's the Messiah or something.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, there's definitely, even in the Gospels, it says that, you know, everyone around them thought that both Jesus and John, particularly Jesus, were involved in demonology and controlling demons, and that that's how they worked their miracles. And, you know, yeah, the interesting thing about John, too, which we write about quite a bit, is that he's considered to be the father of Gnosticism, really, because this sort of, I would say, practical father of Gnosticism was Simon Magus, was actually John's student.
Mm-hmm.
Although Simon Magus is considered a villain in the Bible, you know, he had quite a number of followers, and there seems to be a tradition coming from him, you know, that influenced all of the Gnostic traditions that came afterwards. So it does seem like, you know, if Simon was John's student continuing his tradition, and then Simon went on to found these Gnostic traditions, well then, you know, John must have been teaching the same thing too. Now, you mentioned a little bit about what Gnosticism is. I mean, the basic commonality between all the very different ideas, sects, religions that consider themselves Gnostic, or are well, I guess none of them consider themselves. It's sort of a label that was put on all of these groups afterwards.
Right.
But the thing that they have in common is that this idea that there's a larger God outside of creation, you know, and beyond the God that created this world. And so you have really two different attitudes about that too. So some of the groups acknowledged that, you know, there was another God on the outside, call him father of all or something like that. Then there was the Demiurge, who's the one that created the world we're in now. Some of the groups just sort of acknowledged that, and, you know, that there's these different levels of creation and existence. And then some of the groups villainized the creation itself. So, like, when you look at most of the Hermetic texts, which also reflect this idea, and they talk about the Demiurge. And in fact, Plato talked about the Demiurge. It was not necessarily, it was a philosophical idea long before it was associated with these weird sects and cults. But the Hermetic texts basically just acknowledge this fact.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the Gnostic groups, like I said, villainized the God of the Bible. They were, in a way, rebelling against the Judaic and upcoming Christian influences that they were surrounded by. So what I think happened over time, too, is that these Gnostic groups and their teachings developed into other traditions that were even more, I guess, rebellious against the, you know, what was becoming the prevailing spiritual order. So as Christianity became more dominant, these Gnostic ideas sort of went underground and took an even darker form.
Right.
But even the original Gnostic sects, the way that they're described by, admittedly, their enemies, the church fathers, they describe them as being involved with really blasphemous and promiscuous sex orgies and sacrificing of infants and things like that.
Mm. Similar stuff to the Templars under their confessions, right?
Yes, and so several people have theorized that the Templars were influenced by Gnosticism, which in fact we did find some evidence of. So, well, one of the people that accused them of that was Pope Pius IX. He had this whole, you know, I guess you would call it a bull that he put out. It was quite lengthy, where he's describing the Freemasons and the Templars and their, you know, what their secret beliefs were, and he definitely describes it as being, you know, Gnostic as being one of the terms you would use to describe it. The other really important person who considered the Templars to be Gnostics was Joseph von Hammer Purgstall, who in the early 1800s wrote this book that really influenced what everyone else wrote about the subject of Baphomet afterwards.
Right.
And what they wrote about the Templars afterwards. So, you know, whereas I told you that Baphomet was really a severed head to the Templars, later Baphomet became depicted in the drawings of 19th century occultists as a human figure with a goat head, and the human part of the body is a hermaphrodite.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, this is greatly influenced by this book by Joseph von Hammer-Purgstall, which we had translated in order to be able to complete this book, because it had not been translated from the Latin, and very few people had actually read it since the 1800s. So, you know, we translated this, and the whole book is about how he thinks that the Templars were practicing Ophite Gnosticism, which is a sect that, for sure, they are associated with snakes and rituals with snakes.
Interesting.
But he kind of thinks that he definitely believes the church fathers' accusations that they were involved in these really extreme orgies. And his evidence for that is all these relics that he said he found in churches that are built on former Templar properties. Now, a lot of these churches don't exist anymore. A lot of the towns they were in don't even exist anymore. And people have been writing about this guy's book in a derogatory manner for quite a while, even though he was a very respected Orientalist during his time. And his works are even still considered textbooks to be referred to on other subjects, such as the Assassins. But this one that he wrote about the Templars has just always sort of been dismissed. Well, not necessarily during his time. It was very influential during his time, but I would say in the last 100 years or so, been written about in a very derogatory manner. But from what I can tell, the people writing about it just didn't read Latin and didn't actually read the text.
Hmm.
So, one of the things I needed to mention is that everyone's sort of claimed that these artifacts that he has depicted in his book, which he has line drawings of them, and they're very bizarre, you know, pictures of certainly orgies and creatures with multiple eyes and multiple faces and, you know, androgynous beings with heads.
Yeah, burning a body too, I think, right?
Yeah, and there's burnt sacrifices and things like that going on. Definitely images of children and animals having sex. So anyway, people thought that these images, or some people theorized that it was all made up and that these artifacts didn't even exist. But I actually managed to track down two of them, and I don't know where the rest are. You know, maybe that's a subject to be studied in coming days, but I managed to find two of them that are being preserved by the British Museum, although they're not actually on display. So we have pictures of this stuff. Some of them are on the website now, and they're also in the new book. And we're going to put out a translation of this other guy's book in January, and it'll have all the pictures in it too. But yeah, so really we were able to bring this stuff to light for the first time.
Yeah.
And really there's nothing else like it. There's no one else claiming, you know, that there's any physical evidence of the Templars being involved in these sorts of rites, except Joseph von Hammer-Purgstall's book.
That's really interesting. It's another one of those things that you could point to back up the idea that it wasn't just character assassination, that they really were involved in some of the things that they admitted to under the torture.
I think they were involved in some of the things for sure. I mean, they were involved in a religious tradition and rituals that were totally antithetical to the exoteric front that they were putting on of, you know, being a Christian crusading order.
Right.
I don't know if they were murdering people. Strangely, it seems like that part of the accusation just never really got explored very much.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like I think it's typical of the time, though.
Yeah.
When life was not really treasured the way it is now, you know, where we're more affronted by the thought of a murder happening or a child being molested than we are someone, you know, saying that they don't like God or saying that they love Satan.
Yeah.
But back then, you know, the blasphemy was the worst part, and they weren't even thinking about the sex abuse or the murder as much. So
odd,
it's
but
kind
yeah.
of strange, but that's the way it seems to have been treated at the time. But I should also mention this, in addition to Hammer Purgstall's very controversial book, there's also this other piece of physical evidence tying the Templars to Gnosticism that I think is just irrefutable, because there's three different examples of it, and it's very straightforward. What I'm talking about is the fact that there are seals that the Templars used to seal their documents, you know, such as if they're making treaties with another group, you know, sending letters back and forth to other parties. They would seal these things with, you know, kind of a notary seal. And it actually depicted Abraxas on it. And I'm sure you've talked about Abraxas in the past on your show.
Right.
You know, this is a Gnostic deity. And it's a chimera, very much like Baphomet in a way. You know, it's got a chicken head. It's got a human body, snakes for legs. It's a combination of all these different things, just like Baphomet was later depicted by Eliphas Levi and the 19th century occultists. And it really seems to embody the same sort of concept of the way Baphomet gets interpreted later by occultists when they're talking about him, such as, you know, Aleister Crowley or Eliphas Levi, is always as a symbol of the transcendence of opposites. So definitely male and female, because he's a hermaphroditic being,
right,
but also good and evil and creation and destruction. And the same associations are made with Abraxas.
Interesting.
And the way that they depicted him on the seal, they show, you know, the very typical appearance of Abraxas as the chicken-headed, snake-legged being. But then around it, it said in Latin, secret of the temple. So they're implying that the very heart of their order and the secret that unites them is somehow symbolized by Abraxas.
Wow.
So I think that maybe Abraxas was just another symbol for the same thing that Baphomet was also a symbol of.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, it seems like the connections are there, and it is just so confusing, all the different names and symbols and how the cultures change. And, you know, you do a great job of talking about not just what you think, but what all the different scholars have thought and all the different perspectives in the book. That's probably why it's 600 pages. But talk to us about, apparently with Baphomet, this the etymology, when you go back as far as you can, it seems to be the most accurate translation would be baptism of wisdom.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And that actually was provided largely by Joseph von Hammer Purgstall. He wasn't the first to come up with it, because there have been some other scholars who had basically translated it in the same way. But he really popularized the idea and also just filled it out. He not only said that's what the word means, but in fact, it's a ritual, and this is what sort of ritual it was, and really speculated, but I think in a very educated way, about what they might have been thinking and what they might have been doing. And so what we came up with was that baptism of wisdom definitely seems to be a ritual and a concept associated not only with Gnostics, but Hermetists as well. And that, you know, so that's the baptism of wisdom in a broader sense. And it may be that the Templars in particular had their own version of that, that may have taken on a very dark tone. So the meaning of baptism of wisdom historically probably goes back to this conversation that happens between Hermes and his son and student Tat in the Corpus Hermeticum in the fourth discourse, where he describes to his student that God, instead of giving wisdom to all men, he put it in a bowl, and then he let the bowl descend down to earth so that we would all fight over access to the bowl. And then whoever is not only able to gain access to the bowl, but then has the nerve to immerse himself in the bowl of wisdom, will be either disintegrated and destroyed by it, or will basically be reborn in perfect wisdom.
Hmm.
And, he says to Tat, immerse yourself in the wisdom if your heart has the strength. So it's definitely implied that this is something that can, you know, tear you apart if you're not ready for it. But so this is the sort of hidden divine wisdom we've been talking about here, that in the Judeo-Christian tradition is, you know, something you don't touch because it's scary. In the Hermetic tradition, it's like, yeah, it's dangerous, but if you're strong, you should do it. It'll bring you to your real self.
Yeah.
And then we think that it may have taken on a darker tone as I was describing. Gnosticism became darker, you know, really became turned into something else that ultimately became, you know, Satanism, really. And witch cults in Europe that had a particularly anti-Christian tone to them. All of this, I think, is influenced by the fact that, you know, Christianity was becoming more, you know, obviously dominant and pushing out all other belief systems. And so those belief systems had to go up underground. And then, you know, the symbolism that they already had and were dealing with became fused with the Christian symbolism and, you know, took on an antithetical tone to it. So,
yeah.
You know, later you have Satanists, some of them operating within the Catholic Church itself and actually, you know, nuns and priests doing black masses, which are reversals of the Catholic mass intended to, you know, degrade the God of the Bible and exalt Satan. And really, this is all influenced by the fact that, you know, Gnosticism took on this darker tone as it became, you know, very specifically anti-Christian, I think. Anyway, I think that the baptism of wisdom then turned into a black mass of sorts that the Templars were doing. And, you know, that they, these stories about them, you know, perhaps, for one thing, they are said to have kissed someone's behind during the initiation rituals, right? They even confess to this, and they confess this to the Pope's men also, that mm-hmm. there was this butt kissing going on.
Yeah.
And in the confessions of other groups later on, such as well, not necessarily the confessions, but accusations. There were some confessions, but accusations made against other sort of Gnostic influence groups in Europe, like Waldensians and Cathars. They were also accused of doing these same types of rituals. And this obscene kiss, as it's called, again came into play, and they were accused of kissing the backside of a goat or a cat.
Huh.
I think that this is all connected to what the Templars were doing, I think, basically. I guess what I'm saying is I think that the rumors about the Templars, true or not, and I'm kind of inclined to think they were true, influenced the rituals that other people did in other groups that were of a similar persuasion later.
Yeah.
So I think that the confessions that they were doing this butt-kissing ritual, you know, actually influenced what other witch cults and Satanists did later on.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
And yeah, I think that it was a connected. I think that this was part of this baptism of wisdom ritual, which Joseph von Hammer-Purgstall has all these images of what appears to be the ritual. And yeah, it involves, you know, the obscene kiss, having sex with children and animals, apparently killing animals, and all sorts of crazy
stuff.
Yeah,
what else do you need? Man, this has been quite a ride. I do appreciate you being here. I mean, this is all the dense work you've done trying to untangle all these threads and work through all the rumors and layers of secrecy around this stuff. I know I couldn't do it, but before we go, tell the people where they can actually read the book and follow some of your articles that are related to this stuff.
All right. Well, you can certainly get the book on Amazon now and also on my website, TracyTwyman.com, and I've got quite a number of articles there also. And then my partner Alexander Rivera, he has a website at theaonei.com, and Aeon, of course, is spelled A-E-O-N. And you can get the book from his website also.
Very cool. Right on. Well, thanks so much. This was a huge can of worms, and there's so much more involved that we didn't even get to talk about. But until we can do it again, keep doing what you do, all right?
All right. Thank you so much, Greg. Appreciate it.
You got it. Thank you. Whoa, Tracy Twyman, ladies and gentlemen. Good times. I really like this one. Any show that talks largely about magic or money is probably going to be up there for me. But I've heard a lot of back and forth about if the Templars' dark practices were real or just a mix of tortured admissions and paranoia from the church. But for me, there's enough here to say that I'm pretty confident these things aren't just rumors. And anyone who's not convinced, I definitely recommend her new book. It's a great resource if you want to learn more. It's very dense, 600 pages. That's not for a lack of evidence. And how cool was that, that Tracy said this was one of the biggest audience responses she got from a podcast appearance, right? Thank you for that, guys. That is a huge deal. It's very important. If you do think a guest is interesting, please reach out to them and say your Higher Side Chats appearance was great, because I've been able to get some great guests, but they won't come back unless they feel like it's been worth their time. So if you can bring it to their attention that you heard them here, that really helps my case, because I don't have publicists and marketers and people to make those cases for me. If you thought this was interesting, definitely reach out to Tracy again and tell her you appreciated her work and her time. And Tracy really should be praised for finding these Hammer Purgshall artifacts in the British Museum. We didn't spend a lot of time on the story, but she had to pay the museum who had these things not on display. She had to pay them to take proper pictures, and then she reproduced them in the book. Forgeries are a possibility with these artifacts, but at some point you just got to decide for yourself. And I hope this show gave you some insights into a group of people that everyone loves to name drop without knowing a ton about. Another thing about those artifacts, there is an owl carved on one. Might be part of this ancient spider versus owl struggle, eh? Plus, that's the second British Museum reference just like 50 days after I was there myself. Maybe the universe is telling me I should have spent more time there. Also, another reference from my European trip is Abraxas. Of course, Professor Doom talked a lot about Abraxas, but it was also the name of one of the weed coffee shops in Amsterdam that we kept coming across. Although I went in about 40 of those places, and the other 39 didn't really tie into the show in any way, so maybe it's nothing. But a few of the Plus members had requested that I bring Tracy back on. She happened to just have gotten a new book out, so bada bing, bada boom, the stars aligned. I think it went good. Another bit of news, I was a guest on the Free Your Mind podcast yesterday. Check that out on my Facebook if you want to hear me on the other side of the mic. But we talked a little bit about the early days of THC and how I really had a whole different goal and a different vibe where I was going after comedians. And some people wanted to see some of those shows. And I know I have remnants on my old hard drive somewhere, but I did have one of the big ones, the Joey Diaz interview, on this computer. So I threw it up on the Plus site as a little extra. If you're a fan of comedian Joey Coco Diaz and you want to see me doing a show in video, check it out. We smoked a ton of joints in that green room at the Madhouse Comedy Club, and I was nervous and unprepared. A bit embarrassing, but a lesson that if you keep working towards things and tweaking it and making it better, you'll eventually get there, right? So join Plus to listen to that. But an even better reason to join Plus is the second hour of the show every week, and today is no different. After talking about the Chinon parchment, magic, money, Gnosticism, the baptism of wisdom ritual, in the Plus show, we got into psychedelics and the Grail connection, Adam and Lilith, the idea of servitors in magic, Baphomet pact-making in the music industry, pact-making with the giant blowfish at the peak of a good acid trip. We've all been there, I'm sure. The power of manifestation, black magic versus white magic, as well as the Paris attacks and Friday the 13th and any possible connection. But I don't really need to tell you. You already know the second hour is just as good, oftentimes deeper than the first. So I won't lie and give some story about how desperate the situation is. Everything's going quite well. And I don't want you to sign up because it's your holiday charity. I want you to just like the show. I want you to do it for you because you enjoy listening and the $5 for another 5 hours is worth it to you. And then you got the forums and a couple other extras for good measure. It's not bad. TheHighersideChatsPlus.com. And I will also say that I have the next two THCs already recorded, and these are good. Both come from Plus suggestions, another reason to join. You can contribute to being the nebulous man behind the curtain here, but both guests are great. One show went a little bit better than the other, but I think next week, and I don't want to overhype, but I think a lot of people are going to be very happy. And it will be here soon, but until then, I've done all I can do. I'm going to get out of here, but it's your move, Baphomet brethren and remnants of the Templar Order. Your frickin' move.
Sweet dreams to the elite. We're calling them out on THC. On uncovering secrets and conspiracies. Everybody's looking for something. Some of them want to use you. Some of them want to get used by you. Some of them want to abuse you. Some of them want to be abused.